This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Amazon leaves Charlotte off its short list as a possible city for its second headquarters, Raleigh. And Atlanta, however, make the cut. Cold and snow descend on the south, shutting things down for a day and messing up air travel. Charlotte steps up for the homeless. The city prepares for Women's March 2.0. The remarch is tomorrow. Domestic violence deaths spike in Charlotte. The tax plan impacts area banks. And we have a Panther sale update. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he is senior staff writer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Doss Helms is here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, among other things. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins, publisher and editor of QCityMetro.com, on his phone even as we speak. Filing
good morning.
His latest story. Good morning.
Always working.
And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and a contributor to WCCB News Rising. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, get to us through Twitter, and you can even watch us on Facebook Live this morning, even as we speak.
In Charlotte, we call our downtown uptown, but y'all will get used to that once you come round. We have all four seasons here. Unlike Seattle, it only rains here sometimes. Plus, we have sunshine.
There's a hum here in Charlotte. We're moving and buzzing. We're the number three city for banking. We're like New York's polite cousin.
Oh, my God. That was...
I can't imagine why it didn't work.
New York's polite cousin. That's what everybody wants for a hip city.
That was part of Charlotte's pitch to be the home of... I don't know how he got that, since it seems to be top secret information. But that was part of Charlotte's pitch to be the home of Amazon's second North American headquarters. It didn't work. Amazon announced yesterday that we did not make the short list. They pared the list from 238 cities that submitted proposals to 20. So we weren't on the list. What has been the reaction?
Well, I think charlatans have been there typically insecure selves about this. By the way, if you had the pool for the Amazon HQ2, who didn't have Columbus and Newark among the finalists? So that should make you feel better. Those are two of the finalists.
Newark has an airport.
Yes, that's right. Newark has an airport.
But on the other hand, the Triad and Hickory also lost out. So
that's
we're
right.
A good company there.
That's true. The Triad and Hickory are out. You know what's interesting, and Ann and I were talking about this right before the show. I think the most surprised person, public figure, Tark Bakari, the councilman.
Shocked.
He used flabbergasted,
which is just a great word. Yes. You should use that as often as possible.
You should. It really feels like something from a vintage script circa 1950 or something.
Gambling going on here?
Yeah, exactly.
Flabbergasted.
He was on one of the committees, I think, to design the proposal, which we have not seen. And there's an article in the paper this morning about people wanting to see this proposal because evidently it's being kept in a vault or a mayonnaise jar on Funkenwagnall's porch. And no one
nice reference.
Thank you. It's been a long time since we heard that. But anyway, Bill James and Julie Eiselt say that the public should get a chance to see Charlotte's bid. We should be debriefed, they say. We should know what the dollar figure was.
Absolutely, we should. And the reason is, beyond just the general healthiness of transparency, is we obviously want the city to bid more effectively in the future and see what went wrong, what didn't add up for this. It was interesting. One of the things that Tark Bakari mentioned beyond being flabbergasted is that he hopes Amazon will offer feedback to cities that didn't make the cut. Now, that would be a lot of work for Amazon, so I don't see that happening. But the basic point was...
Well, surely they kept notes in the meeting where they decided who was going to be on the short list. Just give us the notes.
Yes, unless you're of the conspiracy theory that they've known where they're going all along and this is just a marketing ploy. Well, but yeah.
And it is a terribly effective one. I mean, people have been saying, yay, Amazon, in every visible way for weeks now.
I mean, I guess the buses will say Charlotte is prime until 2019 or something. So,
I don't think they necessarily have to give feedback to all of the cities individually, but it would be good to know. Kind of here are the things that we use to make our big decision.
Of course, some kind-hearted, big-spirited people have said we shouldn't ask for this feedback until after Raleigh knows the outcome of whether they're going to be chosen because we don't want to reveal too much information that the state might have put into both of these proposals and nix the Raleigh version. Even Vi Lyles was congratulatory of Raleigh being on the short list.
Anything that happens in North Carolina for the good, it's good for everybody in our state. We are still very attractive for other potential employers.
You see, we are the...
Did you take a drink after that?
we are the polite cousin.
That's right, we are.
In lieu of knowing the reasons, people are speculating all over the place. And so that would also... I mean, they're saying, oh, we don't have the major research universities. Right. Oh, the protests did not put us in a good light. So, and also, that would keep people from speculating. And as you say, we're in bidding for other things, and we've lost out on some other companies bringing a manufacturing here. And so, you know, it's sort of like... To add another pop culture reference, we'll be Charlie Brown, you know, and then some company pulling that football away.
There goes the football. Hey, don't say football. What would the Panthers say?
Okay, we're going to do that later.
But I was going to mention, Mike, real quickly, you know, some of the criteria, mass transit. You know, Charlotte's obviously not New York, even its polite
Raleigh's cousin. Not even Charlotte.
Exactly.
When it comes to that.
And so I was already hearing yesterday people talking about, well, Raleigh doesn't have the same level of transit. Raleigh's airport certainly is nowhere near the level of Charlotte service. So, you know, there are already, I don't know if they're sour grapes, but there are complaints that, hey, wait a minute, when you look at the criteria as they were laid out, how does this make sense that Charlotte wasn't in the final 20? But they're not.
Well, and you mentioned the marketing ploy, and there's certainly been speculation that even if it's not down to one that was locked in beforehand, that they're not seriously considering 20 now.
Right.
That
well, there were some when we talked about this when the bid was being put together, I forgot who did it, but we referenced a columnist or several columnists, maybe one in the New York Times, that essentially said Charlotte has no ghost of a chance in this.
Yeah. Now, there were others outside Charlotte who thought Charlotte might have a chance. I mean, who knows? One of the things that jumped out at me yesterday is, okay, so you have 20 finalists. Three of them are basically Metro Washington. So, you know.
Yes, Montgomery County, which is the richest county in America.
Yes.
Or is it Fairfax? I can't remember.
No, I think it's
that's Northern in Virginia. Well, that's in Northern Virginia. And then Washington, D.C. itself.
And then Washington proper. And as everyone knows, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post.
Exactly.
And so this has long been one of the theories that Washington was going to get it. I don't know, but it is interesting, whoever gets it, that you have three from the same metro area out of 20.
But Philadelphia is trying to, you know, basically coast on all of it, saying, well, we're in between Washington and New York.
The finalists, we should mention the finalists. The finalists are Atlanta, Austin, Texas, I guess because of their what?
Hipness.
Schools, their hipness.
Yeah, education, yeah. And they have a pretty strong tech sector.
Boston, too. Chicago, Columbus, Dallas, not Dallas, North Carolina.
No.
Yeah.
Denver, Colorado.
Not Denver, North Carolina either.
That's right, Indianapolis. Los Angeles, Miami, we mentioned Montgomery County, Maryland, Nashville, Tennessee. Now, that hurts a little bit.
Yeah.
Newark, New Jersey, New York City, Northern Virginia. They're not specific as to what part, but it's all the same. I live there. It is. It's all the same.
Making a lot of enemies.
I'm not saying it negatively. It's just that there's no difference between Alexandria and Fairfax. It's just all the same. Bedroom community of D.C., Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Raleigh, Toronto and Washington, D.C. What's the chance that Toronto might get this, do you think?
I don't know. It was interesting that I think it was the mayor of Toronto immediately went on the offensive and said, we have universal health care. We are very welcoming to diversity. So that is an interesting pitch, sort of given the tenor of the country. Toronto, a very international city. I wouldn't say that that's out of the realm.
Yeah, it's an amazing city if you've been there. It's so diverse. And the way they deal with their parks and all of those things, it's very well run. So why not?
So the Observer's Eli Portillo yesterday reported that one of the big advantages that Raleigh has over Charlotte are ties and accessibility to top research universities, quote, that can offer intern programs, research and innovation incubation centers on or nearby their campuses. Why would Amazon need that? They send boxes through the mail.
Well, they don't just send boxes through the mail. They have probably the most sophisticated system of ordering, processing, distribution, and consumer analytics. I mean, they're doing that all the time. Can you imagine the brain power that goes into making all these systems so efficient? So I think the educational component does make a ton of sense.
I think the folks who move the boxes are already working out on Wilkinson Boulevard. They have a big distribution center there. That's a whole different level of employment.
Yeah.
I want to play the piece of tape that we played at the very beginning of the program one more time. We have to hear this one more once.
In Charlotte, we call our downtown uptown. But y'all will get used to that once you come round. We have all four seasons here. Unlike Seattle, it only rains here sometimes. Plus, we have sunshine.
There's a hum here in Charlotte. We're moving and buzzing. We're the number three city for banking. We're like New York's polite cousin.
You know, nobody remembers the Olympic bronze medalist. The number three banking city. I mean, really? We put that in the presentation? Are we insane?
We're number three. We're number three.
So, yes, we're just trying so hard to be hip.
Especially when we used to be number two.
I know. It's.
Yeah.
Why are we laughing about this? So Amazon is not coming, but before we move on, let's stay with that first letter of the alphabet and move on to Apple. Yes. Apple has announced similar plans for a second U.S. headquarters, and North Carolina Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland says that this date is a natural fit for the project. Here we go again.
Yes.
Will Charlotte turn their focus from Seattle to Cupertino now?
It was funny. I think it was the Catawba County Economic Development Chief immediately answered a question to one of our reporters about not getting Amazon by saying, hey, I hear Apple's looking. I mean, you know, so I don't think there's any doubt that people will queue up in the same fashion. What's interesting is I think that companies are seeing a blueprint here. You know, you get all this attention. Obviously, you're going to get the perks and the incentives and all that stuff. But the marketing bang you get for dragging this process out, my goodness, who wouldn't want to do
that? Yeah, but now nobody from Charlotte will use Amazon. They'll use UPS. So there's a downside.
If you think that people are going to boycott Amazon,
no.
The power
well, that's
of
right.
Prime.
Amazon is not at FedEx.
Did you see the numbers from the holiday?
Yes,
and
I mean,
how the huge percentage of anybody that shipped anything? It was Amazon. Amazing.
Now, one wrinkle to the Apple thing already is that Apple CEO Tim Cook is a Duke graduate. Could this give Raleigh yet another leg up on Charlotte? And if that happens, if they get Apple,
how about
and
they get
Amazon?
Apple and Amazon.
Do we just disappear?
Yeah, I was going to say, does Charlotte just, it's wiped off the map. It's over for us.
We become a suburb of Raleigh.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
the
right.
Airport closes. Right?
Charlotte, the new Cary.
So, why are we laughing?
I don't know. It's
because we'd cry otherwise.
That's right. Yeah. So unlike Amazon, Apple has not yet.
They have not.
Issued a request for proposal, and we don't know exactly what they're looking for, but a New Jersey-based site selection expert says that North Carolina, and Raleigh in particular, is clearly an early front-runner.
20,000 jobs, I think they're talking about for this next campus. And by the way, this is the money that they're bringing back from overseas, or part of the money, I should say, part of the money they bring back from overseas. But yeah, the answer to the question is I think everybody will whip themselves into a frenzy again to try and get Apple. I mean, there are only a handful of companies like this, so every city wants a bite at the apple.
I want to talk about an inferiority.
That was terrible.
Inferiority complex. Should we be getting one now? Should we be worried about this? Because if we also lose the Panthers, that's not a good thing.
Wow. You are piling on today.
And should North Carolina be worried about this? Because we just lost, what was it?
Toyota Mazda.
Toyota Mazda.
Say,
so if we don't get Apple and we don't get Amazon, what does that say?
Well, it says it's a continuation of what's been going on, which is North Carolina has been basically ineffective at closing out the deal on these large-scale economic development projects. I mean, the state and the cities we're talking about obviously are growing at very healthy rates, but when it comes to landing the big one, North Carolina hasn't gotten it done.
Well, we've gotten it done with the courts because the Supreme Court handed down a big decision yesterday, not a final decision, but a stay of execution, so to speak, and we'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping public radio advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. Knight Foundation believes informed and engaged communities are essential for healthy democracy. More at knightfoundation.org. And the Charlotte Symphony, performing music of Mozart and Haydn, including Mozart's Magic Flute and Haydn's Farewell Symphony, tonight and tomorrow night at Knight Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. Less than a month into the new year, and Charlotte has already witnessed four murders, and in each of those killings, there was a thread of domestic violence. CMPD receives about 35,000 domestic violence calls every year, but after the police leave, or even before they are summoned, what help is available for victims? We look at that, at the prevalence of the problem, and at what others can do to address it Monday on this program at 9.
I'm John Harwood. Coming up on the next On Point, Steve Bannon subpoenaed by Robert Mueller. Talk of a government shutdown again. And the Koreas to march under one flag at the Olympics. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point following Charlotte Talk's local news roundup here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Guess who's here? Eric Spanberg is here from the Business Journal. Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, WCCB. And Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer is here. Well, 2 weeks ago, and we've talked about this in the past, the Fourth Circuit Court gave the legislature 2 weeks to redraw and submit new congressional election districts. Both Senate Leader Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore were unhappy about this. Tim Moore says that when it comes to drawing congressional election districts, North Carolina nailed it and says ours is a model other states should follow.
We feel confident that the districts that we have drawn are constitutional in every respect. And ultimately, if the court follows through with the precedent that's been in place for many, many decades, we believe the court will rule in our favor.
Well, yesterday, the Supreme Court temporarily blocked the Fourth Circuit Court's order requiring lawmakers to revise or produce revised congressional voting maps next week.
It's like a snow day.
Yeah, exactly. And the court's move was expected but not particularly telling because they didn't say much about this.
No, they didn't. And it seems like everything is pointing to the Supreme Court's ruling expected in the spring on the Wisconsin gerrymandering case. And again, we're talking about partisan gerrymandering instead of racial gerrymandering. And so what happens now is that the congressional districts will stay in place for 2018, we think.
We think.
Unless the Supreme Court decision changes that.
So the primary is in
May.
So the Supreme Court could decide this spring that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. And if the Fourth Circuit Court has ruled that our districts, our congressional districts, are in fact partisan gerrymanders, and the Republicans in the legislature pretty much admitted to that up front. One of the guys said the only reason it's 10-3
is because they couldn't get to 11-2.
That's right. Yeah. So that's fairly evident that it was partisan gerrymandering. So in May, if they come back and say that's unconstitutional, what does that do? Does that mean we have to put the primary on hold? What does it mean?
Well, the first part of it is, when do we get the decision? Do we get the decision before the primary or after the primary?
And if it comes in after the primary, what happens?
Then the courts are going to have to figure that out.
Filing starts in about 3 weeks.
Yes.
So there's really, you have to know what district you're in, I think.
Right. I think that essentially what a lot of people are doing is operating on the premise that it's going to be this way. Now, if it changes, it's yet another mess. I mean, I think the interesting thing is we've gone through this in North Carolina for literally 4 years. And the most damaging part of this is that voters are so confused. I mean, there's so much back and forth in terms of the court battle that people, even if they're trying to keep up with it, can't figure out where the districts are going.
I think people can't. I guess I would challenge that the voters are confused. I don't know if voters are sitting around hanging on.
They may not be paying attention at all. That's
exactly.
True.
But I think your bigger point is probably correct. I think it's probably more confusing to people who want to run for office or people who are already in office. What was surprising to me was the number of liberal judges who actually sided with the majority. And so for that reason, I tend to think you're probably right that they're waiting for the Wisconsin ruling.
And we also have a ruling coming up in Maryland on the same thing, partisan, although this was actually Democratic instead of Republican. And I think it is fair to say that voters, if not confused, are frustrated, because it seems as though we have so many politicians that are wanting to pick their voters instead of the other way around. It's a little bit of a loss of control. And because it's been in the courts for so long, I think people are just saying, can we just please get this done? And you have different experts trying to do the picking and the redistricting, states like California have a bipartisan redistricting, but now you just can't get other states to agree on that.
It's interesting. Tom Bullock, obviously from WFA, did that interview with Speaker Moore this week, and one of the things he asked him about was whether the people of North Carolina, in essence, are getting a fair shake because of these gerrymandered districts. And Speaker Moore said, well, let's just go back to 2010 when the Republicans took the majority in both chambers of the legislature. Those were in districts drawn by Democrats. So that's clearly, you know, the Republican thesis there. The other piece that you hear from the Republican leadership a lot is, hey, look, the federal courts don't need to be interfering in North Carolina's congressional districts or anything else.
But the Congress is a federal office.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just telling you, this is the position of the Republican side.
It's also true that gerrymandering and redistricting has become much more exact since then.
Yes.
You have the technological advances, so you can pretty much say this House will vote one way and this House will vote another. So I think to say that neither technology nor politics have changed since has changed since 2010 is a little disingenuous.
And remember,
I think
the same
bigger point stands, though. There is a way to remedy this, and the Republicans did do it in 2010. They were able to get into power because the Democrats stayed home after the 2008 election, when Democrats showed up in droves to elect Barack Obama and just swept the Congress. They just sat back, and Republicans were able to get in, not just coincidentally, but on the year when they took the U.S. Census, and it put them in a great position to redraw those boundaries.
And we're coming up on a new census.
We are coming up on a new census.
But how many districts, and we're dealing with gerrymandering, both political and racial gerrymandering in North Carolina between the
legislature
and the congressional.
The 28 districts, right, legislature.
How many of those seats, either congressional seats or legislative seats, is there only one candidate from one party running? Are they mostly legislative seats where that happens?
I think that's mostly legislative seats. I mean, usually in a congressional race, you're going to have somebody opposing, whether they have much of a chance or not.
Because Speaker Moore's point to Tom Bullock was that voters, if they think this is unfair and they don't like the way these districts have been drawn, legislators will be held ultimately accountable for this by the voters. But really?
Well, and I think that was part of
situations where it's rigged so that there are so few Democrats in a district that they can't possibly win.
There's definitely a power of incumbency that you are known, you are getting support from people who know that you are in a position of power. It can be hard to overturn an incumbent. So,
and there's also the packing and cracking, which is the vernacular of, you know, you basically create the districts so that you know which ones are going to be Democratic and Republican, and obviously, when the Republicans are in charge, they try and make fewer Democrats and vice versa.
But you'll see that basically Republicans are counting on that. But Democrats see some hope in the fact that you look at Virginia and other places where you had these unopposed folks, where in this year's election people did come out and you saw a little bit of a turn and a change. So they're saying, okay, we're going to compete in some of these districts, and who knows what's going to happen, because maybe folks are disgusted with what's going on. You saw that happen in Virginia, and just recently in a state race in Wisconsin, where in a district that the president had carried by like 20 points, the new Democrat beat an incumbent. And you saw even the governor there saying, you know, we're going to have to watch it and really listen to voters, because it's not going to be a cakewalk.
So this temporary block on North Carolina's gerrymandering ruling by the Supreme Court yesterday, in that decision, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor were the dissenting votes. So what does that tell us about a potential decision coming this spring in the Wisconsin and other cases? We have the only two judges dissented to this particular state.
I don't know that I would read a lot into that, but I mean, those are two different things, because you're weighing on the one hand deadline pressure, how that affects an immediate election, versus with the Wisconsin case and the Maryland situation that Mary mentioned. I mean, then you're analyzing what has happened. That's a much more straightforward court decision, I think.
And they'll say it's not on the merits of the case. This is just on this particular thing. Although Republicans obviously are going to say, wow, you see, that means that we have a great case.
I'm putting a little bit more weight on that. It's all speculation. But as I said before, I just can't imagine some of the more liberal judges voting that way if they did not have some reason to believe that the bigger case is going to come down and settle this thing.
Okay. We've had two severe cold snaps so far this January, at the first of the month and again this week with the added complication of snow. I know that because they have yet to pick up my trash or recycling. Parts of the Carolinas got 5 inches of snow. Atlanta reportedly got 1 inch of ice, which doesn't bode well for their Amazon bid. We seem to have coped pretty well with this time around, don't you think?
There were power outages. There were a substantial number of wrecks. But overall, I mean, yeah, that's to be expected. Most people had a couple of lovely snow days.
Yeah, there were several hundred accidents across the state. One accident in this part of the territory included race car driver Dale Earnhardt Jr., who must be very embarrassed.
Yes. That's why he retired, apparently.
Yeah.
But he tweeted it on himself, so he must have found it amusing.
He said he center punched a pine tree. I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah. It sounds very aggressive, though, doesn't it?
But I didn't see all the traditional stories on television about running out of bread and milk in the grocery store. Did we have that?
Yeah, have we matured to that point?
Maybe.
Or do we just order from Amazon?
Well, one thing you did see, though, was are we really equipped to handle the homeless and folks who are out there in this kind of weather? And you saw particular cases, you know, about the Urban Ministry Center and others reaching out because, you know, are we equipped for that?
So one thing, and you just alluded to this, Mary, one thing that the snowfall and the falling temperatures led to was the opening of the Grady Cole Center as a warming station for the homeless. During our first cold snap earlier this month, and we talked a lot about this, there was a disagreement between County Commissioner Pat Cotham, who thought that the county should have opened Grady Cole back then, and County Manager Dina DiIorio, who pointed out that the county had established criteria for opening Grady Cole and other warming centers, and that incident in the first part of the month did not meet the criteria. The county's director of emergency management explained to us, I think it was yesterday or the day before on this program, why the county did open the warming station this time.
What occurred differently this time is there's cold and then there's cold with snow and ice. A big difference. This time we had more demand because more people wanted to come in. It forced more people to want to come inside, so it went beyond our capacity of our normal sheltering program.
That's Rich Granger on yesterday's program. Do we know how many people used Grady Cole? Any idea?
I don't think we did. We were talking about this before the show, and I think everybody got so busy covering a million and one other snow stories that I have not seen a story saying X number of people reported to Grady Cole.
So one thing that jumps out is I didn't hear from Pat Cotham. I just didn't notice the same level of concern. Now, obviously, they opened the center, but I didn't hear.
And they opened it before the first flake fell.
Well, there you go.
Right, because it got a lot harder to get out on the streets.
Right.
Last time around,
yeah.
It was very, very cold, yeah. But you
they
could drive without risk.
They opened it at 5:30 on Tuesday night.
Okay. Yeah.
So maybe that's why we didn't hear any complaints, because
they'd
already done it. They cut it off at the knees.
There you go.
Do we know if shelters had to substantially, the other shelters in town, had to substantially expand their capacity? Because cold is one thing, snow and cold is another.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I would give you sort of an anecdotal, which is similar to what the county did. I didn't hear much in the way of people saying that there wasn't enough capacity or that people were unable to get shelter if they wanted it. So that's the limit of my knowledge.
Of course, some of the homeless don't come inside. They don't want to come inside. They refuse to come inside for various reasons. And Allison Winston at Urban Ministries, who led a team to check on homeless people uptown, explained the challenge this way.
One of the biggest challenges for me personally is kind of working with clients who are not willing to go to the shelter, because much of our population are folks who are camping or who have severe mental illness or are kind of like in the throes of substance abuse.
So for those who chose to stay outside, they actually do get some extra help, don't they? Doesn't someone drop off like sleeping bags or
they had a huge influx of donation of sleeping bags, heavy winter gear, hand warmers, feet warmers. So yes, I think Allison Winston and her team, she has four people and they are out there, and approach A is always please come to a shelter, we'll help you get there, and approach B is if you're going to be outside, here's what we can help you try to stay warm.
And also, it seems like a pretty sophisticated system they have in terms of going back to people where they know they might be, trying to convince them again. So it's not just a sort of pell-mell. I mean, they've got a pretty strategic approach to this.
And it's my understanding there were plenty of beds available, and they had that really taken care of and covered.
Now, we've had several school days, snow days at CMS for obvious reasons. And you just told me before we started this program today, Ann, that there are people mad about makeup days. Really?
They are, yes, because CMS actually has the approved school calendar is longer than the minimum requirement. So there are people who are saying, why do we need makeup days? We'll still meet the minimum requirements. And the reason is they lock in their makeup days in advance. They had 7 of them set aside. 2 were in December, so we're down to 5. The first one is going to be this coming Monday. They were supposed to have a teacher work day, and they will go to school, and they will start back. High schools were in the middle of exams from the first semester.
Right.
The next one is February 19th, which is kind of a random day. They're also planning that as a makeup day. After that, you get into the first day of spring break and 2 days after the end of the school year. So what CMS is thinking is, winter is not over. January is not even over. So if you blow off these next couple of makeup days and say, oh, we'll be fine, and then you have another event, whether that's, you know, winter weather, whether that's a big spring storm or something, now you're left with some makeup days that are really going to make people mad because people do not want to lose their spring break, and it would just be crazy to add them.
I was going to say, wasn't it a couple years ago, Anne, there was the threat of spring break and parents went absolutely bonkers?
Yeah, that's nobody cares about school calendars until it makes them mad. There was one year that they used the Martin Luther King holiday as a makeup day. That was a mistake.
Peter Gorman, and Fort Lauderdale gets upset, too.
That's right. They do.
About
they do.
All this. Yes. But correct me if I'm wrong, there was only one school day today, this week, right? They had Monday off.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been kind of a crazy, you know, since they came back. They had a half week that was very, very cold right after they came back from winter break. Then they had a nice, full, solid week. And, yes, they had Martin Luther King Day. They went to school Tuesday, and now they've been home.
Of course, the snow was deep enough and of the proper quality to build snowmen and for the city of Charlotte to issue an official social media snow angel challenge. The Observer reported on one that involved an empty CMPD patrol car with an officer lying in the snow, flapping his arms a la snow angel. Very angelic. And Mayor Vi Lyles tweeted a video clip that looks like her.
She says it is her. It actually doesn't look like her. It looks like a person bundled up in here with some little eyes peeking out. She was not doing the shirt sleeves.
My favorite part of this whole drama, though, was that the officer was wearing short sleeves.
Yes. Yes.
And the mayor tweeted and said that he has to put on his coat.
So now, we don't want him out taking a sick day.
That's right.
Another splendid use of social media. Yes. So is this a Charlotte first? Have we ever done this before? Is this officially – I said it was an official – social media snow angel challenge. Was this a city thing that we actually?
Well, the city of Charlotte's Twitter account said, you know, there was not like they didn't hold a special city council meeting and pass a proclamation, but it was basically Vi Lyles' granddaughter was in a tweet making a snow angel. And so Vi Lyles got out and made her own snow angel. And then whoever does the city's social media account said it's an official challenge.
So now, I mean, Mike, the pressure's on you.
Yeah. And now you know why we lost the Amazon.
Well, we'll know we'll get snow in another.
Get that in the video.
All right, there's going to be a nice weather tomorrow. The snow's going to be gone. It's going to be warm, and women are going to be marching. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Horak Talley, whose lawyers strive to help clients achieve their goals and protect their interests from the bargaining table to the courtroom. Details at HorakTalley.com. And Hendrick Acura, offering over 145 new vehicles in stock, including the 2018 TLX, MDX, and RDX models. Details and options at HendrickAcura.com. The clock is ticking toward a potential government shutdown this weekend. Immigration could be the sticking point. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon is subpoenaed by the Russia Special Counsel, and North and South Korea agree to march under one flag at the upcoming Olympics next month. Just some of the topics they'll be talking about during the continuation of the News Roundup, the national and international version during On Point. Guest host John Harwood is in the corral, this unruly bunch of reporters. I'll continue to do that in just a moment. We're coming right back.
It's that time of year for new beginnings, new goals, new habits. So why not start with something simple, like, say, listening to Morning Edition? One button. It's all it takes to connect you to the world and to your community. Listen every day.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 5 until 9, here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. The weather is warming up. It should be really nice tomorrow, and by Sunday, really, really nice, which is good news for those participating in tomorrow's Women's March. This is a follow-up to the march here and around the country last January following Donald Trump's inauguration. Jan Anderson, who helped organize a Charlotte trip to the march in Washington last year, and he was director of this year's march. And Laura Meyer talked about the impact of that event.
The march energized us to act. It's a beginning. It's not a be-all, end-all.
I think the march galvanized women into those roles that they didn't even know that they were able to do.
So, Mary, you've been covering this, and you'll be at the march tomorrow. I think, Ann, you'll be at the march tomorrow as well. What are the reasons for round two?
Well, last year, I think it came off as sort of a protest of the election in many ways. It also wasn't the one in Charlotte anyway, as well, I would say, organized in the beginning, and they were surprised. I know they were estimating about 3,000. I was there. About 10,000 showed up. The police perimeter started getting wider and wider. I think you will see greater diversity of participants and ideas and causes. You'll see it's more organized. You'll have speakers. I think our mayor's speaking, and I think at this point they're, as I say, a little more focused in round two, and they want people to realize the first march wasn't just this is the beginning and the end. We were building on something, and it will be informed also by the Me Too movement, both specifically but also in general, about women speaking up about a variety of issues.
And this will be happening across the country as it did last time around. I think last time, as Mary said, was very much a reaction to Donald Trump's election and to Hillary Clinton's non-election. This time they're very much looking forward to the 2018 election.
Well,
the national theme is power to the polls, and it's about getting out. And they try to be, you know, not explicitly partisan, but it is certainly more Democratic than Republican movement. It's certainly a progressive liberal causes.
I was going to ask about that because we had Jan on the show with several other women who were part of the marches last year and who will be part of the march this year. And I said, is this open only to liberal women? Are only liberal women and men going to feel comfortable in this? Because this seems to be, we got some emails while they were on the show from women who are conservative and who say pro-lifers are not welcome. Are they welcome?
Well, you will actually see in Washington you have now the March for Life that's going on, and it's not anti this, but it is showing that point of view, and the president will have a speaking presence, I think, by film to the march, which generally presidents don't weigh in on. I think this is wants to be open, and they want everyone to be welcome, but you do see basically a lot. You will see some pro-choice signs and this sort of thing.
Planned Parenthood, there's one of the speakers is from Planned Parenthood. I think that support for women's health and reproductive rights is going to be a pretty strong thing.
So last year's marches in Washington and around the country, in fact around the world, but the ones in this country were the largest ever one-day demonstration in the history of the country. If the marches this time around don't meet that kind of critical mass, is that going to be a disappointment? Is it going to be something that ends this because it didn't meet up to what happened last year? Was extraordinary. Can you do that again?
I remember,
if you don't, what's the impact
on the show last year, you asking me, kind of putting me on the spot, how big is this going to be? And I was saying, well, there are 3,000, you know, yeses on Facebook, but I was hedging because, you know, we never have 3,000 people at a march in Charlotte.
Yeah, 10,000.
Yeah. And now they say they have 7,000 RSVPs. So I'm still going to hedge because you just never know who really comes and who doesn't and who brings their whole church with them. But
and as Ann said, the focus is different. It's on action. It's looking forward. It's on registering women, electing different candidates. A lot more women have put in to run for office. We have an African-American woman mayor here. You've seen in other states just women stepping up to the plate. And you've seen the electoral power of women in a place like Alabama that basically, taking party aside, had someone accused of molestation running. And his opponent won, powered by women, and particularly African-American women.
It's interesting. I spoke to Jan Anderson this week, and she was talking about, you know, their nonpartisan group. And yet you have five elected Democrats, Alma Adams, the congresswoman. You have the mayor, somebody mentioned. You have three Democratic councilwomen. So I think it's a bit of a tough argument to make. And the main event nationally is in Las Vegas, the Power to the Polls, and the speakers are Congressman John Lewis and Senator Elizabeth Warren. So it is a pretty left-leaning event, yeah. I would say.
Yes.
Mary alluded to it earlier, but it will be interesting to see if they are successful in making this one more diverse. There were the last one was somewhat diverse, not nearly as diverse as the city. The organizers this year are making a concerted effort, working with some black women's organizations, trying to get more African-American women to participate. So that will be interesting to see as well.
There's a speaker from the Latin American Coalition and from Muslim women of the Charlotte area. So there, yeah,
they definitely got that message, I think.
Well, that from Washington, remember, there was a little controversy over the planning of it until they diversified the planning committee. So you have that whole issue of intersectionality that comes out. And there was actually before then an effort made to say, well, it's not going to be that successful because people are fighting amongst themselves. But they did get it together.
Yeah. When they were on the program the other day, I mentioned that according to the Rutgers Center for the American Women in Politics, the number of potential women candidates for the U.S. House in 2018 is double that of 2012. There were 161 in 2012. There are 354 so far this year, and the filing hasn't even been completed. Can you attribute that either to last year's marches, to the Me Too movement, or just some sort of awakening in the zeitgeist?
Well, and I think also what Mary was saying earlier, when you look at the success of women who ran in 2017 for office, I think that's a big part of it too, because when you see anyone go out and succeed, then you start to think, I can do that as well.
What surprised me after last year's march were the number of small organizations throughout the nation, actually, but here as well, where women came together and just formed these little neighborhood groups or organizations of 10 or 20 people or even fewer to say, hey, we need to become more politically involved. There was a group there was a big gathering of such organizations in NODA shortly after that, and they represented everything from animal rights to reproductive rights to you name it. So I think that has helped as well. Behind the scenes, there are lots of little organizations where women are coming together in small groups to exercise their political power.
Mary.
And you don't want to forget the men. There were quite a few men at the march, and there have been supportive organizations. That was funny. There was a black fraternity giving out water and such last year. But also, as we were talking about the partisanship nature of it, we live in a very basically polarized times. So it isn't really just about gender. It's about many things.
So this kicks off tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock with, a rally with speeches at First Ward Park, which is right down the street here on 7th Street. And then the march begins at noon. And in the paper this morning, they're talking about planning ahead for parking and transportation, because there's no way to know exactly how many people are coming. It could be 7, it could be 10, it could be 2, it could be 20,000 people. Yeah. Who knows? So are people suggesting that you come into town on the light rail?
Yes, they're definitely encouraging you to. For one thing, it's expensive and it's hard to find parking if you're not familiar with Uptown Charlotte. So if you can park in a light rail lot and ride in, that just seems to make a lot of sense. You're going to end up doing – if you do the march, you're going to end up doing some walking because you go from point A to point B. So – and they're saying with people with limited mobility, the thing to do might be to just come to the rally, because last time there really wasn't a formal rally, and it was so packed that you couldn't hear what people were saying. This time I think there will be more of an opportunity to listen to speakers and cheer and then go home if that's what you feel like.
So it starts at First Ward Park and it ends at Romer Bearden Park.
Yes.
Is that what it is?
There's 17 speakers, I think, something like that. 2 hours of speeches anyway.
Wow. Okay. Let's move on to something not good. The homicide count last year was the highest it's been in Charlotte in decades. And so far this month, we have experienced a spike in domestic violence deaths. And Karen Parker, who is CEO of Safe Alliance in Charlotte, who will be on this program on Monday, says the number of killings is alarming, but if there's a silver lining here, it may be that bringing attention to these tragedies is spurring victims to speak up.
We know a lot of victims are listening to the stories and watching all of this play out. And, of course, many of them who are in these situations are becoming more fearful and maybe wanting to reach out and get help.
27% of the homicides last year were domestic violence related, and CMPD gets about 35,000 calls a year, about 40 calls a day that are domestic violence related. Do we have the resources to handle this? I mean, if everybody came forward and said, I'm in trouble, would we be able to help them?
That's a good question. I don't know that we can.
I'll ask that question on Monday then.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that I certainly can't answer that. Maybe someone else can. But the thing that strikes me about what's happened in the past week or two is right at the beginning of the year, Mayor Lyles was speaking to the Rotary Group uptown, and someone asked a question about homicides and public safety. And she immediately started talking about her discussions with Chief Putney about domestic violence and its role in the homicide rate, and you look at what's happened here in the last week. I mean, it is obviously a tremendous, tremendous problem, and it's one of the hardest aspects of homicide to solve because usually they're people who live in the same home.
And one of the more dangerous calls to go on, I'm told by police. And in York County, as you alluded to, it's not just the spouses that are the right victims here. In York County, a sheriff's detective critically injured in a shooting in a connection with the domestic violence call died this week. Three officers were wounded.
Well, you see that they are seeming to look for solutions in the – we've talked before about those family justice centers mm-hmm. that try to just take it and not as an isolated report, but see what can we do to figure out how to solve the problem. And as we were talking earlier, Mike, this is a huge problem all over. When we have these mass shootings like the one in the church in Texas, it turns out in many of the cases – that there's a history of domestic violence. There's been a report. There's something happening. And also we've talked about guns in this, how folks are able to get guns somehow. And if that happens and it's a domestic violence case, then it's going to turn deadly.
Yeah. And
Jane Wester, the Observer's police reporter, has a really interesting story that's online now. It hasn't been in print yet, but in which they've done studies and said the biggest predictor of a domestic violence situation that will turn fatal is strangulation, choking. That they've gone back and analyzed cases that did turn fatal and said, what do they have in common? So evidently, that's one of the biggest predictors, that if you have someone who comes to the ER, obviously, you know, not dead at that point, but the person's been, you know, wrapping his hands around her throat or otherwise trying to cut off the airways, you really need to direct very serious resources to that person, because that is one of the most likely cases, even if the killing is not done that way, but that there will actually be a fatality.
So we'll spend the hour talking about this on Monday with people who are on the front lines of trying to find help for people who need it in these situations. I want to move to a story that would not even be on this program had it not been for an earlier problem at Wells Fargo. But some Wells Fargo customers are unhappy again because they say their bank accounts were drained or overdrawn when their automatic bill pay setups were charged twice for payments. Was this ramped up because of the previous account scandal? Did they say that some of these customers view this as just another attempt to vandalize their accounts? or is this just a computer glitch and people are upset because it's a computer glitch and for a moment they had a problem?
Well,
all of it's been taken care of now, I'm told.
Yes. I think that people are going to be mad no matter what, and you add social media and, of course, they're going to tell everyone exactly how mad they are. And I'm not trying to make light of it, because the thing that stands out to me is that Wells Fargo cannot get out of its own way. When you look at the past 2 years, what's gone on at that bank, and by the way, this week the chief risk officer announced that he will be stepping down. You look at what happened with –
it's a risky job.
Yeah, it is. You look at the so-called sham accounts. You look at what happened with the mortgages, some of the auto loans. I mean, they've had one thing after another, and their credibility is taking hit after hit after hit. They've got a lot of work to do to repair their reputation with customers and prospective customers.
And we're all relying more and more on digital automatic payments, which this was the situation here. If you had it set up that your water bill or your mortgage payment or whatever was just going to come out of your checking account, and all of a sudden it was pulled out twice and you're overdrawn, now you've got a lot of people upset with you. And I think the additional fact that they could not reach somebody to talk to and get it straightened out was making people
And by the way, people do not forget things like that. They don't forget little glitches like that.
And you're left cleaning it up, because it's a lot of time to clean that mess
absolutely.
Up.
And Wells Fargo just has not established a trust.
No, they have not.
Well, meanwhile, both Wells Fargo and Bank of America reported lower fourth quarter earnings, which both banks attribute to the new tax law. They expected this, and it will supposedly be a one-time only event. Why?
Eric? Basically because of the tax cut and these losses on previous deals that the banks kind of hang on to so that they can use to lower their tax rates.
They unload them into the – yes. They would have spread them out, but right. Now they're going right. to unload it because it's the law changed and they can't do it again.
Because it's not going to be worth as much.
Right.
So at the same time, look, Bank of America, $18 billion profit for the past year. So they're going to be fine. And the long range, I mean, when you see companies handing out bonuses to a lot of their employees, that tells you additional bonuses, that tells you that they're probably faring pretty well financially.
Well, they did hand out bonuses at both banks because of the tax cuts. But Bank of America reported on Wednesday that the bulk of the company's savings from this new tax overhaul will be passed on to shareholders and be used for corporate stock buybacks. This is exactly what experts said would happen.
Yes.
The politicians were saying it would trickle down to higher salaries among employees. That doesn't seem to be happening. Is there any evidence that eventually it will trickle down?
No, I mean, I think those experts are absolutely right. And I think that the sort of SOP for public relations is that they do these one-time bonuses, which obviously are not recurring. And so then you hit both of those angles with the public. That's what they hope.
Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Mary C. Curtis
you got it.
From Roll Call, and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.